My name is Chris Deasy, and welcome to the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. And this week, we have something a little bit different. Now, it's 2 years to the week since my first nostalgia interview was broadcast, but this is the first interview that has taken place online. So, you know, if you'd said to me a few years ago, who's Zooming who? I think you were referring to an Aretha Franklin hit from 1985. But no, Chris Gordon is my guest this week, and we conducted our interview over Zoom. Now, Chris runs a podcast called Hellblazerbiz, in which he interviews people who are in the movie business. He tells us how he got into it, how he was once talked about on the red carpet at a premiere in Los Angeles. For his podcast, Chris gets fans to ask questions to his guests. He talks about how the experience of interviewing has been likened to catching up with old friends in a pub. We learn why independent actors are more likely to want to put themselves out more, and why Matthew Modine didn't want to be interviewed by Chris. Now, Chris studied German at Lampeter from 1994 to 98. It included a year in Germany, and Chris talks about why Lampeter was his coming of age and the place which set him up for the rest of his life. We learn that he came to Lampeter from North Wales, why he likens Lampeter to the community in the sitcom Cheers. And Chris also reveals that he was half an hour late for one of his finals exams because he was drinking cider in the student union bar. Now, we talk about how we have moved on after 25 years, and Chris talks about how he listens to the same music now that he did back when he was at university, but has more recently developed an interest in country. We talk about carrying something from the past into our futures, and what he is trying to capture through his interviews, likening it to a time capsule. We reflect on the strong political opinions that people had at university, and Chris talks about how he perks up whenever Lampeter appears on the news. Chris talks about being a massive film fan and being so moved by Schindler's List, which he saw as a student, remembering the solemn exit from the arts hall afterwards, and how that wouldn't have happened had he seen it elsewhere. Then at the end of the interview, we learn that Chris's biggest regret is not joining the forces. He's been working in IT for the last two decades, which we find out is pretty different to what he originally expected to be doing. Now, Chris would love for his podcast to be his main career and to knock James Corden off his top spot. And the interview ends with Chris asking me who my Muppet character would be. So join me for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews, this one over Zoom, with Chris Gordon. My name is Chris Deasy. And it's great to have Chris Gordon here as my guest. Chris, it's been, gosh, 2 years, exactly 2 years actually, since I first did one of my Nostalgia Interviews podcasts. And this is the first time I've undertaken an interview online because of the lockdown. So we'll see how this goes. And of course, wonderful to have you as my guest. And obviously, we know each other through the Lampeter Society, but we've never actually met in person. But what we do have in common is that we both run a podcast. So I'd love to hear a bit more about what it is that you do.
Hi, Chris, by the way. Well, that's a cool. Thank you for doing this. It's great. It's very strange to be interviewed as well. But yeah, no, my podcast is called Hellblazerbiz. It's a very strange name. It started about 5 years ago. It was called Ramblings of a Hellblazer because you'll probably find out I like talking. We did it in support of a TV show that had come on, and it was cancelled after 12 episodes. And people were getting really despondent and disheartened. And I was on Twitter, and it was the first time I was on Twitter, and I couldn't say everything I needed to in 140 characters or less. So what I did, I just started up doing a 5-minute show of impressions, character impressions, and making people laugh and motivational stories and pushing them across for people to listen to. And they loved it. Everyone loved it. I ended up meeting a friend who was a production assistant on that TV show. And I said, so I think someone mentioned, wouldn't it be a good idea if she came on your show and you talked to her and got background information about it all and stuff. And I brought her on, lasted 40, had such a great chat, getting all the information. And then it went from there. And eventually, I think within about 2-3 months, I had all the main cast had been on, and they spread it around. And it's kind of built from there. So yeah, kind of now, it was originally only for that one show, but now I kind of just, like yourself with interviewing everyone, I opened it up and reach out to any actors, actresses, filmmakers, directors and stuff, and just bring them on to chat.
No, that's amazing, because I'm guessing as well that because you've interviewed a few people, then it steamrolls and somebody else will say, actually, I heard that interview, or of course they're thinking, that interview took place, good word of mouth. Great publicity for a fledgling actor, need all the publicity you get. So in a way, it sounds like you came along at the right time.
I think so, especially with that show. I've got to say, I'm going to give me my little claim to fame, because this is what I tell everybody, because I'm just so proud. It's when I just started, there was an actress called Angelica, well, she's Angelica, but she's Latino, so it's Angelica Celaya, who was in the show. And I was trying to get hold of a director who was directed it was Constantine, the show originally, which is where Hellblazer comes from. That's the kind of nickname from it. So I was trying to get hold of this director, TJ Scott. And when I actually eventually got him, he's directed Gotham, Battlestar Galactica. He's done lots of things like that. And he told me when I finally got him on the show, he goes, I remember, because Angelica, he goes, she came to the premiere for his first ever independent film. And he said, we were talking on the red carpet to my premiere in LA about me. And because she said, you've got to go on Chris's show. So I was like, right, so hang on. I was like, calm down. So you were on the red carpet to a premiere in Los Angeles and you were talking about me. He was like, yeah. I was like, wow.
but I'm guessing that before podcasts, and this is my experience as well, you're often in conversation with people, you're thinking, I wish for posterity I could record this. So what I have found, and it sounds like you've had a similar kind of experience, to interview people, in some cases, dream people, but also just somebody you have a casual conversation with who has in some way impacted on your life. It might be somebody watching a film and you think afterwards, I hope they go far and they've made a real impression on you. But to have a 45-minute or an hour conversation with them that you can then effectively in that time encapsulate all the key things that both of you want to talk about is actually priceless, because you've got that for posterity. You can look back and say, you know, this is how it all started. And when you ratchet them up and do loads of these, as both of us are doing with our respective podcasts, I guess it's impossible to stop. Is that your experience?
It is, yes. Because, I mean, you do get despondent as well, because I'm sure, I know we've chatted about this before, but obviously with when you get people viewing numbers or listening numbers, because I do the video as well. And I look at them, and sometimes I get despondent when I see, so I'm just like, oh, really, is that all? Especially when my son's playing all these YouTube videos by the most inanely stupid people I've ever seen in my life. And they're raking in millions each month because of money, you know, because of all the subscribers they're getting. And I'm just like, how can they do that? But then for me, it's a sense of that posterity. I don't care if I've got one listener or 1,000, because at the end of the day, it's something I found that I enjoy. It's an outlet. And you're right, we have that for posterity. We have that piece now. We have that 45-minute, that one-hour conversation that's recorded. That will never change. That can't be changed. That's something that you know yourself, you've done. And you'll never be able to, you'll never change it. And it's great. And it's a nice feeling, but you can't stop. Mm-hmm. I keep thinking I'm going to have to stop soon, because especially with COVID at the moment, it's really difficult getting guests. Like, you know, you can't, you travel around personally, like you said, and you can't do that now. So you're trying to find other ways. But for me, everyone I interviewed, a lot of people have started their own podcasts. So a lot of actors, even ones who would love to interview, they're bored now because they've got no work. And so they've started their own. So whereas I'd normally reach out to get them on my show, I can't, because they're doing their own one. And it's like, so it's
yeah,
kind of.
Yeah, and I was thinking the same thing, because I think that having a conversation can work really well, because you can bring out the best both in your guest, but also in yourself, because you're listening to what somebody is saying. You've got an opportunity then to follow it up. And in some cases, although I use a preconceived list of questions, sometimes, you know, I scrap them, throw it in the bin, because the conversation is covering all the same things. It's like an old episode of 3-2-1, you know, the 80s show with Ted Rogers. And I remember once he asked a guest something along the lines of, or she may have said, oh, I'm a dentist. And a minute later he said, so what do you do for a living? And she said, well, as I said, I'm a dentist. And I thought, he's not listening. He's just got his list of questions. He's nodding his head. And if these actors that you're speaking to are doing their own podcast. That's great. But are they doing it on their own? Is it really solipsistic? Are they just interviewing themselves?
No, some of them are bringing other people on. Some of them are just doing other things. But you're right. And I think that's an art that you've got with your guests that you have. And it's something that I've built up myself. And, you know, sounds like I'm boasting. It's not being boastful. It's something you do when you do this kind of thing. And you like you've done with yours, you do listen. And you brought that out perfectly because I have a list of questions and I get fans to send questions in as well. But then you're right, halfway through the interview, I'm looking at my list and I'm starting to panic because I'm thinking, we've just talked all about that in pretty much the first 5 minutes. What am I going to say now? But it's so relaxed, the conversation, that there is an art to being able to pick up on a conversation, pick up what someone has just said. Like you said, Ted Rogers didn't do that, but being able to pick up on that and then just take that and flow. And I think in some of the interviews I've had, they've been really quite surprised by that. And I think a lot of the people who listen, they say it's old friends catching up in a pub. That's the style that it comes across as. And for me, I was like, well, it's work then. Great. It's like, you know, if that's what people think, then it means that the conversation, because conversations with the star, you know, that conversations part works. And it's very, very important in life in general, not just in a podcast, to be able to actively listen to what people are saying, not just, you know, just like you say, listen and then forget what they've said. It's to actively listen and then and work on that.
And I think also that it works when you're obviously listening to what the person is saying to you. But also somebody said to me that they were either travelling on a bus or they imagined themselves travelling on a bus. And the interview that whoever I was listening to, they could imagine that person sitting next to them, or, you know, they were eavesdropping. And I suppose I like to think of someone being on a bus listening to this and thinking, well, actually, I need to get off at the next stop, but I want to stay on a little bit longer because I want to see where this goes. And I guess that in some respects, you can be interviewed like film stars. You know, what comes to mind is Gina Davis when she was promoting The Longest Goodnight in 1986. And I was really excited because Steve Wright, I was an amateur at the time, Steve Wright was on Radio 2 Saturday morning. And he said, Gina Davis is on the show today. And I thought, oh, wow, this is amazing. She's a big Hollywood star. She's going to be on this programme. But of course, it was a pre-recorded interview. And it was with one of his colleagues. I think it was Tim Smith. And it was in a hotel room. And they'd only been given, like, you know, 5 minutes, and 5 minutes on Radio 2. Barry Norton probably had the same 5 minutes. And the press would have had the same as well. And, of course, the questions were all about, did you do your own stunts for the film? And what was it like to be directed by your husband, Rennie Harlin, etc.? But that probably wouldn't even have been allowed anyway, because there would have been a preset list of questions that would have been vetted. And of course, as you're listening, you're thinking, this is so generic. Well, I don't want to know if you did your own stunts. You know, there may be wider questions there about, how do you feel about filmmaking? Do you feel that you are being stretched by this? Or what you think about your career since Deborah Louise? Do you kind of feel that you're doing new and creative things? Are you getting new offers, that kind of thing? But I also thought, those are not the sort of questions that Gina Davis is going to be able to answer or would want to answer, or in the limited time available, if you're promoting The Longest Goodnight, how far can you go beyond the official rationale for the interview to take place? And I'm guessing that when you're doing your interview, you're dealing with people because in many cases they haven't quite reached the top of their ladder. They may be trying to say as much as they can to please their audience. The higher up you go, the less likely you are to want to do an interview like this, because you're thinking, why do I have to do an interview like this, talking about myself? Has that been your experience?
Definitely. I think, I would say so. I think there's 175 now I've done in 5 years. And I say some of them are from top shows and they're great. They're some of the leads and they are so relaxed and so nice. But I do a lot of independent actors, and you're right, because they're the ones who want to push themselves out. They want people to know more about them. And they do. They find themselves, you know, they're just openly talking. I just let them flow. There's been one or two times I've had to do some serious editing because quite afterwards they've turned around to me and said, could you please edit that out? I wasn't supposed to talk about that. I've just, and then I'm sitting there all smug thinking, I know, you know, because I've got a secret, you know, that kind of thing, because they've let something slip that they shouldn't have let out. And which has been quite big sometimes. But yeah, a lot of them, it's the higher up. Yeah, I've tried to reach some really big names, and there's no chance, because they, like you say, they're up there and they're like, well, I don't need to do a podcast with this guy. Why would I even want to do something like that? And then also the higher up I find, you get the publicists, and they're like doctor's receptionists. So you've got an extra barrier between them when they're coming out. But I do find a lot of the time, not all the time, but I'll say a lot of the time, the independent guys, the ones who are up and coming, they do open up a lot more, and they're much more receptive to, you know, the different types of questions that I've got. I've got a signature one as well. I'll talk to you about that later, probably, which I use, which throws everybody.
Well, don't forget that, because I want to hear that. But you just made me think. I remember once when Neil Diamond was being interviewed live on Radio 2, and it was amazing. Simon Mayo was interviewing him. He was about to do a concert, and I think Simon thought he had like 20 minutes, but after 5 or 6 minutes he was only on about his third question. But you could see that he was suddenly thinking, you know, hang on, somebody's telling me to do something, you know, I'm on live radio, somebody's telling me to stop the interview. And whoever Neil Diamond's agent was under the impression that the interview was going to be very short, and Simon Mayo thought, although it was his own radio show, it was a live interview, was effectively ushered out of the room. And I thought, there you go. There has to be a way, I thought, of doing amazing interviews with people who genuinely want to be interviewed and want to talk, rather than somebody who kind of is so important that, you know, the interview is really for the benefit of the person doing the interview, rather than, for example, for its own sake, or indeed for the sake of their own career, which already at that point is so well established.
Exactly. I mean, to be honest, I consider every interview the benefit of me rather than those guys anyway, because I'm getting to geek out and do something I enjoy. I'd say there's one person though who did come back. Actually, no, there's two. There's only twice out of all the people, and I'm quite open to say the people's names, because one was Matthew Modine, you know, from I reached out to him on Twitter, and he actually did respond, but I asked him to come on the interview, and he said he doesn't want to do the interview. He says, because everyone knows everything. He goes, what I show on screen is what people should know about me anyway. Because if there's nothing people don't know about me from what I show on screen. So I responded. I said, thanks for the response, but that's actually what you show on screen is a character. It's not you. And that's what I was trying to know. And I never got an answer after that.
I found it interesting, because it's funny you mentioned Matthew Modine, because I was only this afternoon looking for Pacific Heights, which I think is an amazing thrill. I was looking for it this afternoon. I've been trying to get it on Blu-ray for years, and it's not a European. It may be available in Japan, but it's well over 20 quid. And I was thinking, especially after what you just said, I'm not so sure. I want somebody who I really think is going to make me want to spend this extra. But I always think Robert De Niro, for example, is an amazing actor. But if I saw him in the street, I kind of imagine that you wouldn't say, oh, hi, yeah, let's have a conversation. Because I might be awestruck by his films like Taxi Driver, Cape Fear, Raging Bull. But they are characters. And Robert De Niro is also very well known when he does do interviews, when he's on chat shows, that he doesn't tend to say very much. So I can imagine he'd be the last person you'd want to interview. You know, amazing actor, but the disparity. But in what he does on screen and what he's like as a person, I think he's a bit of, you know, I'm sure he's a lovely guy, but I can imagine that he puts all of his energies into his on-screen performance. So an interview with him would be a lot harder to sustain than an interview with someone that maybe went to the same university as yourself. Maybe, you know, somebody I've worked with or fellow colleagues who in a way have a very compelling narrative, and they're used to the kind of spontaneous talking that an actor who has a script is not really going to be, you know, quite so able to do. And that's why I find at the Oscars sometimes, you probably find the same thing. You have these amazing actors who start stumbling over the words when they're, you know, introducing Best Actress. It can't be that difficult to read the script and, you know, just read out the five nominees. Why'd you get it wrong? Why'd you open the envelope at the wrong time? And you realise that, of course, what we see is a very polished performance in a film. So Matthew Modine, very interesting. I wonder what, in that sense, he didn't want to come across.
No, yeah, I think it was because of Stranger Things. It was actually another Stranger Things one, was the second person, who was David Harbour. He plays the sheriff in Stranger Things. I'd actually managed to set an interview up with him, and I was sat on Skype. At the time, I was working, as well, I was working anyway, but I was coming home at 5:30, and then I normally set my interviews up in the evening if they're in LA about 8 o'clock, about midday, about that in LA. So I'd actually arranged through his publicist that we'd all arranged. We've got the Skype IDs, everything set up and sorted. And it was actually going to be at 6 p.m. because he needed it to be early. So I just said, right, okay, that's the time I spend with my son. This was way back a few years ago when he was younger. So that's the usual time I spend with my son, but we'll set it up. So I set it all up and I sat there and I had him on Skype. He was online And for the next hour and a half, I actually, because I desperately wanted to speak to him, being Stranger, you know, huge. I messaged him. I called him on Skype about 6 or 7 times. No response. I sent several messages saying, "Hi, I'm ready. Where you are, David? Please let me know when you're ready, and we'll set off." And over 90 minutes, I didn't get one single response. He never answered my call, despite the fact that we'd already arranged it. And the following day, I just got a curt email from his publicist when I said he was online, he was showing there, he just wasn't responding. "I'm sorry, but it's not possible to do this anymore. Goodbye." That was, you know, that was 90 minutes. That's the only time, I've got to say, out of all of them, that I felt really sort of like angry. I was like, that, you know, because it's like time wasted then, as you know how much time goes into preparing for these things. Yeah. And just to have that turn around just because all of a sudden he got famous overnight, that's what I think. So
yeah, and I found sometimes I've traveled to interview somebody, and I think in some cases, to be honest, I just feel it's a privilege to interview anybody full stop. But I do find that sometimes maybe they don't quite realize this is something I'm very serious about, and I put them out every 9 days. Obviously I've had to reduce that during lockdown, but sometimes you'll travel somewhere, and I'm very happy to travel across the country, but you get there and they say, "Well, actually, is it okay if we do the interview some of the time, maybe do it over Skype?" And you're thinking, well, of course that's fine. If you don't want to do the interview, then the last thing I want to do is have a reluctant interviewee. But then you're thinking, but why did you agree to it? But I mean, that happens very infrequently, but when it does happen, it does kind of force you to have to rearrange your entire schedule. And if you've promised people you're going to do this, and they say afterwards, "Where is that interview with such and such?" And you say, "Well, actually, it will happen, but it's to be continued. We're in negotiations."
Exactly. That's what I had to tell people in the end, because people, I'd already told people to send questions in, so I had them flooded in, and it was just, I think it was, you're right, it's just, you know, it is a privilege to interview anybody, and I'll never ever not have that, think that myself. It's a privilege. But yeah, I thought that one occasion out of, to be fair, as I said, one out of over what 170, where it is, it was just rude. And I'll put it down to that. And but no one else, everyone else has been great.
But then again, as you say, you're obviously going to have one or two slightly awkward interviewees, and then it kind of, when you've got a pattern, you realize that the more you do, you kind of know how they're shaping up, and you feel that you found your own voice. And I think that's the crucial bit. If you start trying to emulate somebody else, then it's not your podcast anymore. And what, you know, you might as well just give pre-conceived interviews, generic emails, and do them over email then, rather than do them in a recorded way, because there's no real character to them.
I was about to ask you, have you ever had anyone, or I know it's probably quite dubious to actually answer this one for you, likewise for me, to be honest, who just give you one-word answers? And they're quite, and it's difficult like that, because, you know, that's really hard.
Yeah, well, no, it is. And I always feel at the beginning that there were some people, though, who did some really good interviews with me after I'd done the editing. But what they would sometimes do is say, you know, "Is that a good answer?" Or, "Is the sort of thing other people say?" Or in some cases, you know, back to Ted Rogers, I was genuinely listening to them, but they may have said something that I misconstrued it, or I wasn't listening, and my follow-up question sort of contradicts something that they just said. And some people have been brilliant when that happens, and they just find a way of carrying on the conversation and almost, you know, ignoring what I've said. But one interview in particular, which was really good, she would sometimes say to me, "Is this okay?" And at one point I threw her, because I asked a question that didn't seem to correlate with something that she'd said. And she was really thrown by this, but we carried on, and I took about 10 minutes out of the interview altogether. But it was a really good interview, and I think she was just a bit nervous, but it was a brilliant interview. And I think sometimes what happens in those cases is that I keep talking, and there's a point where they'll say, "Hang on a minute, I really do have things to say." Because if I'd suddenly said, "The interview's about to start, here's my first question," and there's a pause, then of course you've lost them. But they might think, "Do I want Chris to do all the talking?" So there are ways around it, but the editing is pivotal, and you must have found that as well.
Oh, definitely. I was going to say that I've had one where I chatted for about, and we ended up chatting for an hour, just over an hour and a half, because, and it was just, as you said, it flowed, and it was great. But the editing, that was the worst editing I've done, because it took me 7 hours, because after the hour and a half, I was asked then to cut out every and, you know, he was from New Zealand, so every other word was yeah, you know. And he asked me to go through and cut out every single one of them and reduce it down to 45 minutes. So I had to go back and edit 45 minutes of the interview, which was a fantastic interview. The whole thing was great. But I had to try, and it took me 7 hours to go through every you know, and take all those out and then reduce the whole thing down and you know, do the editing to 45 minutes. And eventually I played it to him. And then a week later, he got back to me and says, no, you know what, let's just do it again.
Oh, really?
He said, yeah. He goes, it was great. He said, I didn't feel relaxed at the time. He goes, let's do it again. And so the next time we did it, he was in the bedroom with his kids and they're playing around him. Because the first time he was all suited and booted. And the next time he was in his kids relaxing. And then he turned around and said, if there's anything from the first one you want to throw in, just throw it in. It's fine. And I said, do you want me to edit this out? No, don't bother editing. It's great. I was like, what?
But that's something I learned really on, because if I invited anybody to listen to the interview back, very occasionally they would, but most of the time they haven't. But on the occasion that somebody has asked to listen to it afterwards, it's because maybe they do feel a bit uncomfortable, they don't like the sound of their voice, or they're not used to doing this. And on those few occasions, they have said, it sounds great, but actually I don't like the way I sound, or, you know, can you maybe not put it out, or can you just use it for your own research? And I get a bit disappointed, because I think, you know, honestly, it was a good interview, and they say, it's not about you, I just don't like the sound of my own voice. Maybe it'll never see the light of day, but maybe in 5 or 10 years' time, it might say, actually, what was the problem? So it's nice to know that, obviously, I wouldn't breach the privacy if somebody's asked me not to put it out. But I think when we did the interview, and you never know, maybe in the future, it'll be gold dust, and they'll be saying, you know, actually, that was a really sort of important time in my life, for whatever reason, and having that record of that. I mean, obviously, one of the questions I'll ask is, what are the main influences in your life? What's got you to the position you're in now? And you're on a journey, we're all on a journey, and it's good to have a concrete record of that at a particular moment in time. Because if I ask them the same question 2 years or 20 years later, they might come out with very different answers. So you've probably found the same kind of thing.
Yeah, very true. I've actually had one last week, an actress I interviewed last year or the year before, and she just did this week, she's just asked me, no problem for me whatsoever, it's just to take it off. Can I take it? She goes, nothing to do with me at all. It was just her view. She doesn't like what she said on there, and her views have changed a lot on certain things. And which is exactly kind of very similar, it goes down the line. We've recorded that for posterity. That's how it was at the time. But since then, obviously, she's an actress who's making her way in the world. And she just said, right, okay, my views, I don't think my views have come out as well as I wanted them, you know, as well as I meant them. So she's asked me to take that offline completely now, that one interview, which I have done.
And the whole interview with her, not just a few bits.
Not just the part of it. Interview. She asked me to take the whole interview off. And she said, we'll gladly do another one. Because she said it was lovely, you know, she would do another one, which is great. But yeah, she just said the way she looked at things has changed since then, since we did interview. So that time capsule, like you just talked about, yeah, which is great, yeah, it's now changed.
So. Well, there is a rather well-known Oscar-winning actress from not too many years ago, who, it turned out, after she won the Oscar, she came out with all sorts of conspiracy theories from the past which came to light, which politically might have cost her the award. It's like with Robert Altman, when it was thought that because of his anti-war leanings in the past, I think it was when he was up for Gosford Park, he might have won, but at, you know, at one point he was the favourite to win Best Director. And it was thought that because we had the Gulf War at the time, the Iraq War at the time, it was thought that maybe his views were out of sync with what Hollywood was looking for at the time. So I can kind of see where that actress was coming from. But I guess from your point of view, you know, you feel vindicated. It's not about you. It's, you know, she's the one. You know, you're the one who's being consistent. Because obviously both of us have a Lampeter connection. And I think, am I right in thinking that you were at Lampeter just after, but I was there as an undergraduate in 1991 to 94. We must have crossed over. And you were there, what?
94 to 98, yeah. So I went in, October or September 94, whenever we started. I think it was October, wasn't it, we started? So October 94 through to, 98. But my third year was in Germany. Yeah. So, 96 to 97, I was out in Germany.
And I'm guessing it was a modern languages degree?
It was, yeah, German. I did German at the time, which sadly they don't do anymore. They stopped all the modern languages for quite a long time. Shortly after we left, actually, I think. Nothing to do with us. We weren't that terrible. And they thought, no more. But obviously, they changed it. But yeah, it was German. I did German language. So it was a lot of literature, business, and things like that. It was a really interesting degree. And it was a great department.
Yeah, my sense of Lampeter as well, because I did theology. And theology went from being
a good but fairly small department when I started in 91. By 2001, it was a massive department, and religious studies, Chinese studies, Islamic studies, religious studies. But one of the things is a department like geography, which was huge in the early 90s, and I know lots of students who did geography for their degree, they'd have to do more first-year geography modules than any other subject, because it was so big, human geography, physical geography. By 2001, the department had closed. So it was very funny to have been there for 10 years and to see those sort of changes. And of course, now 20 years on, to no longer be in Lampeter, but to be associated with the university through the Lampeter Society and see so many quite chronic changes. And I think this is the place where I made my mark. It's where I started to grow up at the age of 18. I had come of age. Did you have a similar kind of experience?
Definitely. I mean, I've been back since as well. And like you say, the theology department has. It's really expanded even in those years since. And, you know, they've got the Islamic studies building and everything now. So it's really encompassed everything, which is I take it's what its roots were, original roots. But it was sad to see other departments going. But yeah, definitely Lampeter was my coming of age. I've never, ever forgotten the place. It's, you know, I'm, 45 this year. So it's umpteen years ago. So since we've been there. But it was... it's something magical. It's where it's like you've just said, it's where I grew up. It's the friendships there that I started to make as an adult rather than as a child, and find my own way and learn how to stand on my own two feet as much as that could be done at university. It set me up for, I would say it's actually set me up for the rest of my life on how I think and how I behave and act. Maybe not how I behave, because if I behave like I did in Lampeter...
well, I'll edit or not edit as I see fit, but there are some stories I clearly want to hear. But where did you come from? Because in my case, I came from the big city, Cardiff, and went westwards. A lot of my school friends thought that was a strange move, because to go from the city, a lot of them went east, but most of my close friends stayed in Cardiff. But I kind of feel that in making the move westwards, I went to a place where everybody knew each other. You could really... make your mark. It was the sort of place that, because it wasn't easy to leave, in the sense that if you didn't have a car, then, you know, there was no railway station in the town. You kind of felt that you stayed there, you made the most of it. You were there in the evenings, you were there for your lectures, sort of made the most of it. But in your case, Chris, where did you come from? Where were you before you moved to Lampeter at the age of 18?
I was actually in where I am now, in North Wales, on the coast of North Wales. I was originally from Watford and Hemel Hempstead, so a big city sort of London area, but we moved up here about 1990, so 4 years before I went to uni. It was still quite quiet. It wasn't a city life. It's not a city life up here at all. So it was, for me, just Lampeter. I don't know, I can't remember. I think it was, I chose Lampeter rather than... you know, some of others, it depends on clearing. I went down there. I've come from, I'd say it's slightly, but it's obviously busier and bigger than Lampeter. You came from, the north coast of North Wales up here. So, south, whereas you went west. I just went south.
You went south, yeah. And in my case, I had a sister who was there before me, and we overlapped because she was doing postgraduate studies while I was there as an undergraduate. But there was something about going to Lampeter. And I think that whereas now I would find it very hard, perhaps, apart from the fact that there were some wonderful pubs in the town, to maintain that sort of commitment. Because what do I do of an evening now? I'm a huge film person. And what do I do of an evening? I go to the cinema. And that was one thing that was a treat. But at the age of 18, there was something really special. I don't think at the age of 18, my personality was sufficiently formed so that I could say, you know, this is what I'm going to do. It was more a case of, I found out fairly quickly the sort of things I wanted to do, the sort of things I liked. And I think maybe I stayed in Lampeter for a bit too long because I was moulded in Lampeter. But there should have been a point where I said, Lampeter's given me wonderful skills, wonderful things to do, the confidence to go and explore the world. But I kind of stayed put, thinking, well, I've achieved all these great things here. So if I stay here, I'll achieve some more great things. But I don't think that's the way it works, because you went to Germany for a year. I don't think I even left the UK. I didn't get my first passport until about 2000, when I went on a film festival to Switzerland. So I kind of look back and think Lampeter made me. But my goodness, why... You know, it's the old expression, you can take the boy out of Lampeter, but you can't take Lampeter out of the boy. And I think maybe 10 years, after 10 years, I'd started to stretch the elastic. But it sounds like the 4 years you were there, similar to me in my undergraduate days, were so foundational. And for me, whatever happened to me, I look back on those years as a bit of a golden age. It sounds like you had a similar kind of experience.
Definitely. I mean, I've always said that those 4 years that I have were some of the best of my life. It's, you know, you do, and it's because I think it's the right age. And like you said before with Lampeter, because I class Lampeter as the Cheers University. If you remember the old Cheers program where everyone knows your name, is the pub. That's exactly what you just said. I think that's what Lampeter was like, and I think that's what drew. And it's drawn on me ever since, is the fact I've never really known a location, or if I'd gone to Bangor, if I'd gone to Liverpool Uni, it would never have been that same sort of feeling or the same sort of lifelong feeling that I've had and I hold for Lampeter. Because like you say, because the Lampeter's never been taken out of this boy. I can tell you that much straight away. And those 4 years that I had there, it was very eye-opening. It was very... it was educational, obviously. Probably not as educational as I should have made it with one of my finals. I was actually sat in the Union pub in having a pint of cider when I think in my final was the following day, and it was after about 30 minutes after it was meant to have started. Someone said to me, "Aren't you supposed to be in your exam?" And this is a final on the one of the worst exams that I had. The subjects was business German, which was horrible. And yeah, and then I suddenly sat there, almost in floods of tears, as I realised I was half an hour late for one of my finals. So probably results in the result I got at the end of the third, but it was still a bachelor's. But it cemented on me ever since, everything about it. It's hard to sum up in words. Yeah. It's the people. I've been back since, and it's not the same. The buildings are there, but I strongly feel that the people... Mm. of that time, the people who were there at the time are the ones who actually made that entire life flow. It's like a life force that flowed through Lampeter, and it was the people who made that happen, because the buildings are the skeleton which are there still, but the people were the blood.
No, and I'm glad that you said that, because I put that to the test many years ago. I couldn't go back to Lampeter because the associations were so powerful, and I'd been there for so long, and there had been so many generations who'd come and go, both while I was there, in the sense of a student generation is 3 or 4 years, and then afterwards I was aware that there were still some people there, some people I wanted to see again, some people perhaps I didn't want to see again, perhaps didn't want to see me again, but I kind of thought I needed to step away, make my mark somewhere else. But I'm glad I went back, because in order to go back I had to meet up in another location with some of the people who had made the place so special. I did that in Cardiff, and some people who'd have no association with Cardiff back in our Lampeter days in the 90s happened to be living there and working there now. And meeting up, what was so strange, that I hadn't seen them in 25 years, but suddenly picking up conversations on the very things, having the same conversations that mattered to us all those years ago. It was almost as though we were stepping back. It was almost as though what happens in our lives now, whether we have children ourselves, we have very different jobs to what we ever countenanced that we'd have when we were at Lampeter, but now we're in our 40s rather than our early 20s. But somehow we thought we have this huge amount in common, which, although we were moulded in Lampeter, we can apply that back to what I was saying earlier about how when I was in Lampeter, I sort of just stayed there years and years rather than applied the skill somewhere else. But it happened with the people. We were in a pub in Cardiff one evening, and it was a case of, we might well have been in the Black Lion in Lampeter or the Student Union Bar. And I think that's what made me realise it's the people. So it was okay to go back to the place, because I knew that I'd only been there for 24 hours, 48 hours, then I would leave again. It was great to see the place again, but also kind of knew that whatever happens, whoever didn't go to the reunion as well as who did, the friendships were inviolable. The place wouldn't destroy them, because they were already forged in the aeons of time, you know, going back to the early 1990s.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, some of my best friends are still, you know, I barely talked to anyone from school who I was in school with, but from Lampeter, still in touch with many of my good friends. And I mean, I met Mark Arnold. Yeah, I met him when I was in London working last year. So I met up with him, and again, it's, you know, it's like no time has passed at all. And Chris Clayton, I believe, you know, Chris Clayton as well. In that, so, you know, him and Caroline, they've got children now. Like, I've got children and married, and they came to North Wales. And we spent an afternoon on the Newbury Beach on Anglesey, and it was like we were back at Clangrannog Beach, you know, on a summer's day in Lampeter. There was no time. It's like, it is, it's the friendships, I think, forged there. they're so timeless. And like you said, it doesn't matter what the location is. If you've got those people that you forged that friendship with at that point in time, no matter where you are in the world, because when you meet back up again, it's there's no time passed whatsoever. And you could be right back in the quarry or the black or the RAM or you know somewhere like that or the command tavern. Well, maybe not the command because you used to get thrown out of there, chased out. Well, not thrown out, chased out when I was there. So, yeah, it's one of that. You know, you could be in one of any of those places again, just because of those people.
Yeah, and I find it really interesting because a place like Lampeter can be so welcoming. But what I think is also really interesting is that those people, if you'd had the chance to interview them back then, because of course we didn't have social media or mobile phones back then, we'd have to stand outside a phone box in the high street for a while in order to get through to your parents, etc. But what I found really interesting is that part of me would like to have the sort of conversation that we're having now back then. But also I think one of the great things about doing, say, the nostalgia interviews is the chance to do that kind of reflection, which you can't do to the same degree at the age of 19 or 20. But have you found that in meeting up with some of those friends again, all those years later on the beach in North Wales, has the passage of time made it easier, more reflective? Are you the same but different to who you were back in the mid-90s?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it'd be wrong to say that 25 years, you'd be the same, exactly the same person. I went my Lampeter, I was coming out of very school where I was extremely self-conscious, for example, and I was very shy. And I'll say I was shy. People probably won't remember me shy, personally, you know, and it was just, but now obviously with the life that I've got behind, when I go and meet those friends again and the experiences that I've had through, I mean, I've done 20 years, you know, in working for 25 years and friends who taught for 20 years. And there's so many different experiences that people have had in 20 odd years that we've got, that when we do go back, there are certain things, we obviously reminisce about everything together and, you know, it's brilliant and remembering all those memories. But you have that extra experience of to be able to, you know, to look back and reflect on things in a slightly different way and say, yeah, it was brilliant. Maybe could have done that a little, if that happened differently, or maybe if I'd done that, you know. But you use what you've experienced since. And I think when I was 19, I was so naive anyway, that kind of age. Whereas now, hopefully I'm not naive. And there's that big, huge change in you where you can reflect so much of life.
Yeah, and one of the things as well I found is that although we may mature, we may grow up, things like musical interests, musical influences haven't changed. And one of the things, of course, at the moment is that we're in lockdown. And I've been caught by this same bug when everybody says on Facebook, can you post your favourite album, your favourite record that you listened to when you were young? And I sort of think my musical tastes haven't changed, or at the very least I go back to the same stuff that I used to record, the stuff that I used to record off the radio all those years ago, which I listened to on a loop and I digitised many years ago. But in your case, do you find that with musical interests, have they evolved over the years, or do you listen to the same things that you were really interested in back in university?
I've got to say, I'll probably listen to the same things, because I will say that even though I'm physically 25 years older, mentally I'm still 20, 21, you know, so I think we all say that. But yeah, so I've still got that music taste. It's, you know, the Queen, Oasis, and I love listening to those old, you know, those old kind of tunes as well. I will say it's matured in one way, if you can call it maturing, because I've really got into country for my sins. Different, you know, it's not the old, you know, not the Howard Keel or whatever it is, but you know, the modern rock country, which is kind of, I really enjoy that. I love listening to that. It's soothing. And this is where my age comes into it. It's in a different taste, is the fact that I like listening to that because you can actually understand the lyrics rather than a lot of the songs now, which are just like and blurring out. That's probably my age, but that's how I feel. But I still go back to, because the likes of Queen, and they were my years at uni, and they'll never change.
No, and you realise when you're turning into your parents, because when I was growing up, well, I was 7 or 8 when I bought my first record in the early 80s. And of course, back then, my parents would say, oh, you know, they don't wear suits on Top of the Pops, or the music, you know, doesn't sound as good as it used to. But now I've got no interest in the charts that are out now. I've got very young children. I've got no interest in the music that was in the charts when they were born. But I'm still obsessed with the charts that I used to write down studiously on a Sunday back in the mid to late 1980s. So it sounds like you had a similar kind of experience. The same album, maybe even the same radio programs that you listened to then.
Very, very possible. And I did see, and I was really, really interested to see that you still got your lists that you did make back then as well. That was, I saw that a few weeks ago when you shared that, and I was like, that was fascinating that you still had those, because I remember, because people nowadays they sit there and they, you know, my child, if I tell him, we sat there and we had to wait on Radio 1 and press record, stop, and then we had, you know, and before they started talking over the end of the track, and he's like, what are you talking about, Dad?
I found in later years, because sometimes I'd record those, and I say that, you know, maybe in the future I'll edit out the speaking, but I realise now that it's the voices in between that are so powerful, because in many cases, those presenters, John Peel or Jimmy Young, Terry Wogan, they appear in all of these tapes. But back at the time, I thought, oh, I don't want those, I want the music. But I realise now that if I wanted just the music, well, I could buy a CD or the record. But there's something about the radio, and it's kind of like one of the things we used to talk about in the playground would always be, did you hear so-and-so on the radio at 8 o'clock this morning? And of course, it wasn't just the record. You could go out and buy the record. It was the fact that we all heard it on, you know, Mike Smith or Mike Reed's Amayo Breakfast Show, and we'd all heard them at the same time. And it was the fact that what was said before it, what was said after it, what the presenter thought of it, what maybe people in those days would telephone into the programme, or because they didn't have text in those days, so you could write a letter, it'd be a few days, obviously, before they'd be read out. But there was something about the community there that was built around the fact that we all heard it at a particular place and time. If it's a record, you can listen to it in your own private space, and that's terribly important. But there's something about live radio, which I think I wish I'd recorded, which I could have recorded. There was even the inane stuff that was on in the background, which I think has also influenced the interviews I'm doing, because listening to Radio 2 of an afternoon at university, beyond in the background, Gloria Hunderford might be interviewing somebody, and all these years later, I'm thinking, I remember that interview, and it was when somebody was caught off guard. It wasn't just a question about, tell them about your latest book or play or poem. It was often about the fact that they'd been talking about something quite incidental, something that they hadn't planned to talk about, something that is spontaneous. And that stuck in my mind. If it was something that wasn't going to be said elsewhere, it wasn't something that was deliberately designed, it was one of those did you mean to say that moments, you can't take it back. And so I've kept a diary. We both do a podcast. It sounds as though both of us want to capture something from those days, and which have followed us through into the future.
I think so, definitely. And I can't put it any better, to be honest, Chris. You're right. So yeah, being able to carry something from those years that we're there, and keep it with us as much as we can for the future, and record. I mean, as you're talking about the DJs there, Simon Mayo, I mean, you know, I listened to him on, well, when he was on Radio 2 until he went, and that's when my taste changed. Well, I listened to it. I used to come home on the evening with Simon Mayo's Drive Time and listen to his Confessions, for example, which he went for years with, you know, things like that. And that's exactly, that's the difference. I wasn't interested in the music, and that's obviously me growing up, obviously, but you're right. It was listening to that banter, the banter between them in the between time, and what did they say and things like that. And yeah, I think capturing the podcasts and now, it is. It's trying to capture memories and trying to capture a time. It's like a time capsule, isn't it? Like with your nostalgia, and I guess in a similar respect to mine, it's capturing the memories, and they're just capturing a piece of time and place that can never be changed and never be taken away. In my eyes.
Yeah, because when you were at Lampeter, what about things in relation to sport or films or politics or religion, you know, all these swirling things that were going on in the mid-90s? I mean, obviously, 94 to 97 would have been the time when we had a Conservative government. There was clearly, we can look back now, and it was so inevitable looking back, there was going to be a Labour government. But there was a real sense that people who cared about this, Lampeter was a bit of an odd place anyway, because what was happening nationally wasn't always reflected there, because then the parties that were likely, you know, to jostle for power were the Lib Dems and Plaid Cymru. I just sort of look back on that period and feel, well, I was both excited by the national picture, but what was happening locally was also very different. So there was something very special, very unique about Labrador, and I'm guessing you picked up on that as well during the period that you were there.
Yeah, definitely. It's definitely a microcosm of society in Labrador. It was very much a liberal environment, which was fantastic to see. We're coming up. I can't actually say that I did too much of the politics because that when I was there, obviously the time that I was going through, but I didn't actually probably take much note of that from my poor side. That was one of the downsides. One thing, if I looked back on, I would have changed a bit. But I was actually very interested in the national side of things, watching the television and going on. But there was some very strong opinions back then in Lampeter itself, and I loved being able to see, like you say, that little microcosm there, and we had those. The different voices from the those party sectors coming through, and Plaid Cymru was very, very well. It's always been very strong in that area, and that's something that, like you say, is not on a national level. So seeing there's a lot of Welsh nationalism and pride of being in Lampeter around there, and some made some pubs no-go areas, and from the extreme side, but very, very fascinating, and I did enjoy. I learned a lot more, I think, about actually Welsh culture when I was in Lampeter than I did where I am in North Wales, purely because I think it was very much of a stronger focal point in the countryside and in the farming environments around there.
And I find all these years later, I still follow the Welsh news. It's very interesting that I'm from Cardiff originally, but I live in Canterbury, not far from the border of Dover and the English Channel. And of course, I'm following what's happening in the Senate, in the Welsh Assembly. I'm following all the developments in Ceredigion. And I think how interesting, because back to what I was saying earlier, you can take Chris out of Lampeter, but you can't take Lampeter out of Chris. And I think, well, whatever happens to the place Lampeter, and even if it does decline, even if the place is no longer quite as we remembered it, I also think it's in me, and part of that need sometimes to try and hold on to that has led to the podcast that I have now been doing for 2 years.
Yeah, definitely with yours, with the nostalgia stuff, that's brilliant for that. And I think that's why I have the need as well, because luckily I'm only 100 miles from Lampeter myself, so that's why I keep having the need and the desire. I want to go back. I need to at least see the place now and then and see how it's developing. And you're right, I do listen to the news and I watch. If Lampeter comes up in the news, I'm like, I'm perking up to see what's going on down there, around, or even Carmarthen or any of those little areas around. You do. It's just something that, like you say, it just never leaves you. And as soon as you hear any mention of it, or you might happen to see the Lampeter colours on a scarf going by. I think a friend of mine, Mark, saw that in London a few years back, and he was like, "Oh, there's someone else as well." It's something that never disappears.
Did you find when you were there as well? Because obviously, I'm assuming you're a great film person, because obviously you interview people in the film industry. But was that something that developed in Lampeter? Was that something that developed in spite of Lampeter? Because obviously Lampeter famously didn't have a cinema, but we'd have all those arts hall film screenings on a Sunday or a Wednesday night, including I saw Clockwork Orange, Taxi Driver, The Exorcist when they were banned and you couldn't see them elsewhere, but I saw them in Lampeter in the arts hall. So did you have similar experiences?
Definitely. I loved the Sunday night film and Mr. Ben beforehand, But no, I did. I enjoyed that. I mean, I was always a film fan, even from when I was younger, in the younger teens before Lampeter. I was always a massive film fan, and Lampeter itself, yeah, I think it might have been the fact that there was no cinema, because when you went to that Sunday night film night, again, it was the people there, but you felt it was a much more special event, wasn't it? Because you couldn't just hop off, like you say, you couldn't hop off to the cinema. I had a car, but obviously couldn't travel because I had no money to pay for the petrol. So yeah, it was, you'd had that one special night on a Sunday when everyone came together, and the film, whichever film it was, didn't matter which film it was, like you say, you saw all those ones which were banned as well everywhere else except for Lampeter. And it just, again, it's a closeness of, and maybe that's something I've had ever since in watching films, is I've wanted to maybe have that closeness of that feeling of companionship when you're going, which you get at Lampeter when you watch, even when you're watching the film, because it was a special, no one ever, it was different. You can go to a cinema now and you've got like 300 people in there and you just don't feel the same. But Lampeter, you could go on a Sunday night to that film and everyone, you know, you could look around and see all the faces around. It's like, you know, thumbs up.
I used to love if I'd been lucky enough to see a film outside of Lambeth, obviously if I'd been to the cinema in the holidays, and then it was showing in the Arts Hall a few months later. And obviously, you know, it's like looking around, seeing how people were reacting, because it was so amazing to actually see something in Lambeth that you'd had the privilege of seeing a few months earlier. And I remember Outbreak, in one case in the mid-90s, always stuck in my mind. I think From Dusk Till Dawn was another, because there were particular moments when people were trying to replicate scenes, for example, set in a movie theatre. People would be coughing, you know, replicating what was happening in the film, and very reminiscent of what's happening there with COVID-19. But people would be coughing and spluttering and laughing, and it was almost as though they were trying to almost bring a Lampeter component, if that makes sense, to something which had been contraband. You know, it felt very odd watching a Disney film, for example, in Lampeter, because we were in a place where, you know, Disney wouldn't ordinarily reach, because there was no Disney store, for example, in the town. And there was actually a funny moment, I think it was towards the end of my undergraduate years, when they showed The Jungle Book, and in the last 10 minutes the sound cut off, and some people just left, and they thought, oh, you know, I'm not staying here, there's no point staying if the technology isn't working. But then somebody had this bright idea, well, we know the film, so they started doing their own interpretation of what was happening on the screen, and it was hilarious. And the bit that I remember is when somebody shouted out, "Take that, you tiger bastard," and everybody erupted in laughter, and we were thinking, why did those people leave? Because that could only happen in Lambeter. If it happened in the multiplex in the big city, then you wouldn't have had that same community feel. And that's the irony. Lambeter had this very weird sense of community because it was so idiosyncratic, but it didn't seem to fit with anything that happened outside of it. And I look back and I always think to watch something in Lambeter felt far more special than what I'd see in Birmingham or Cardiff or Swansea or around the country in one of the big cinemas.
Definitely. I mean, the one that sticks out for me the most is actually Schindler's List. I think I mentioned it on the Facebook group. I remember distinctly going in to watch that film, and it was packed. It wasn't a history one. I think there was a history one, but it was in the Arts Hall. We sat in the Arts Hall and we watched it all the way through. And normally, like you say, you come out and everyone's rumbling and bumping, you know, going down to the Union and having a good laugh. But on that one, I've never seen such a solemn exit from the Arts Hall in my entire life at Lambeter, anywhere since. Not one person spoke. Everyone just sort of slowly shuffled out. The occasional sniff and sob, as it had been, and that's a memory that's always stuck with me. And like you say, I think it's you wouldn't have had that in any of the major cinemas, because there's always someone who loudmouthing, you know, who's ruined something when you walk out. But no, every single person had so much, was impacted and was so respectful of what they'd just seen, that they just walked out. And many would have, instead of going to the student union, where they would have gone, we just filed off back to our rooms, you know, just quite slowly, because it was just such an emotional event. And to this day, 20 odd years later, it's one of the key things I remember in the cinema, in the film club, was that moment, purely because I've never experienced anything before or since. And again, I think that was iconic and individual to Lampeter.
Absolutely. And Lambeter had a lot of those because it was so small. And of course, there were times where there'd be all sorts of pranks, people would be messing around, but also very somber. And people would be very respectful and very grown up. Or there were certain things that made us grow up because we'd made that transition from home. Of course, we could exploit that. We could go down the Union, and we had the luxury of a grant, of course, and we could blow all our money in the first week of term. But at the same time, there was also a sense that some people thought, well, hang on, let's get a sense of perspective. While we're here, what are we going to do? And I think in some cases, people were really committed to some very important causes. And I think it made me feel really quite proud to be there for that reason, because people were really at the age of, you know, 18, 19. Some people would party every night, but some people were very committed to vegetarianism or pacifism, Amnesty International. And in some cases, people would travel around the world in order to fight for a particular cause. But it was the society that was built up in Lampeter that forged that. So what you were saying about Schindler's List, I think, is absolutely spot on. People were aware sometimes that there were certain key moments that people wouldn't have anticipated happening. But they thought, you know, hang on, let me catch my breath. The fact that we're still talking about it 25 years on shows that these, you know, Lampeter had transitory moments, but there were some moments which have been etched very deeply in our DNA. But just something to turn to as we start to wrap up, Chris. But I was just going to ask whether your memories are predominantly positive.
Since Lampeter, definitely. Yeah. I mean, well, married. I mean, I've been married 19 years this year, so that was definitely one of the biggest memories I've got. I can't forget it. She's just out there. No, definitely. You know, that was one of the biggest, most positive things since Lampeter is obviously that, and the birth of my son. I'll say as well. He's now 13 and a half, almost 13 and a half. So that's, you know, memories like that, and just having an ethos in respect to Lampeter itself is just coming out of Lampeter and coming out of, I think my year in Germany did help as well, because that was, again, we talked about this, the time I was only there. I was in East Germany only a few years after reunification, and there was still a lot of hatred towards people. People had lost their jobs in the factory I'd gone to and got a job. So I experienced that side as well. And again, and it's taken that experience and just, yeah, there's just a flow of Lampeter, I think, which is a positive. I can't define any more moments, to be honest, Chris. I say, yeah, because getting married, having my son, and just working, I guess, and you know, telling my son and explaining to my son about things like university and Lampeter and stuff, and that's
where we all look back and wonder what our five, or indeed in your case, you know, when you were 13 and a half, what would your 13 and a half year old self have thought about what you're doing now? Would he be surprised? Or would he say, go away? What would you say to your 13 and a half year old self from the vantage point of being in your mid 40s?
I'll say that's probably one of the biggest regrets is I was going to join the forces. And that's one thing I was, even through Lampeter, all the way through Lampeter, people will remember I was in the OTC and I wanted to join the forces. That was what I wanted to do at the end of it. And my parents pushing me to go as an officer, because that's why I went to university, to get the degree, obviously for future prospects. And I just didn't push myself hard enough, I'll say. And that's probably the one thing. The other one was acting. I loved acting as well. And I was a pantomime dame at Lampeter, which was great. I'd say after that, if I told my 13 and a half year old son, I'd probably say, pull your finger out and train harder. So you could have followed that path. But then if I followed that path in the 40s, forces, I wouldn't have the life that I have now, most, I think. Which is a very strange thing to say, isn't it?
Is the job that you're doing very different to what you did your degree in German?
Yes, I went through my life until I was about age 21, 22, which is when I finished university, thinking I would never sit behind a desk. It's the most dull, boring job that there ever is in the entire world. And for the past 20 years now, all I've done is sat behind a desk working in IT. So it's vastly different to what I thought I would have done.
But one word that I've started to appropriate, to adopt over the last few months, certainly through these interviews, is counterpoint. Because one of the things I find is, like doing the interviews you do with Stars in LA, is probably a nice counterpoint to what you're doing in your job. In other words, you've got a different way of expressing yourself. And I guess I do that because I work in a university. But I also have this great fascination with doing radio type things. And sometimes the two can dovetail. I've got the privilege sometimes of, you know, ensuring that the sort of thing I do in my podcast, I can link with my research. But somebody was saying to me the other day that everyone should have two careers or wear two hats, because you don't want to be defined, in your case, in IT, in my case. I love the job I do. But at the same time, it can't be all that I do. There has to be something else. And we've both found an outlet through podcasting.
Definitely, yeah. And yeah, you are. It's definitely a good counterbalance to working. I mean, I like my job in IT. That's great. And I can't deny that I'm striving to try and make my show the main career. You know, it's something I'd love to do. I always laugh and joke and say, I'd love to, my aim is to knock James Corden off his top spot.
Yeah, and it just goes to show, in a sense, he's an English man who made it very big in America. Just goes to show, if I had had the opportunity to interview him, what would he think about his 13 and a half year old self?
I did try to get him on my show once, and I spoke to his publicist, who said obviously no, because I think it was promoting Peter Rabbit and he hasn't got the time. So I was like, that's fine. I did write back to the publicist in a lovely little email and said, but you've missed the opportunity of a lifetime. You could have had Gordon Corden.
Well, there we are, and hopefully he'll reflect on that. And when this interview goes out, we'll make sure we'll get him on Twitter feed. But it sounds like you're in touch with friends from your past, obviously, and from Lampeter, but with school friends as well.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, very rare with ones from school. I say that much. It wasn't. Didn't really enjoy school, so I've not really kept in touch with most of them. But from Lampeter, most of the people I've been in touch with, and I've kept in touch with over the years, is that it's just that Lampeter bond that we had. It's my roommates, my corridor mates from Lloyd Tom. You know, the very first moment, we still reminisce on the first moments and when we met. And we've always been in touch, and it's whenever we talk, like you mentioned before, whenever you talk to them, it's just like there's no time passed. There's just that bond. And I would say no one from school, but definitely from there. And this Facebook group that's been set up most recently as well, there's names I remember, then faces I'd slightly forgotten, and made more connections now with people, finding out that they, you know, were actually a lot closer than we thought. I actually work 20 minutes away from one person who I was really good friends with in Lampeter, and we didn't have social media, so we'd lost contact, and now I actually find out I work 20 minute walk away. So it's fascinating seeing it, but I've kept those bonds and friendships have stayed through 25 years, definitely.
So I was at a pub a few years ago with a friend, and it turns out that one of the other people I work with was also at Lampeter at the same time as me back in the early 90s, although we didn't know each other back then. But that's the key thing. Even if you still meet people who were at Lampeter, there are still people I'm in touch with through the Lampeter Society, indeed yourself, who I didn't really know at the time. So it's not just a case of dwelling on the conversations that we had and repeat them to death, because they're the people that we knew. We haven't ventured outside of that circle. There are still new possibilities. The fact that you were at Lampeter means that we kind of have a shared insight onto the world, and otherwise neither of us would have lasted the amount of time that we did there.
Yeah, definitely, and that's one of the benefits, I think, one of the joys of that Lampeter, of that shared experiences. Like you say, there's yourself, there's a few other people who I didn't know very well, or might have seen the face, and connecting with them again, and just being able to share and create new friendships just from that experience 20 odd years ago is great, as well as keeping the ones that we already had. It's fascinating.
And my very last question, Chris, are you a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
Interesting. That's a good one, Chris. Okay. I don't know. I look forward. I mean, no, that's a lie. I'm a mixer. I'm 50-50. I'm sat right on the fence, to be fair. I look forward. I look forward to see, obviously, what we're doing, what plan the future, what the future will bring for me. But there's always, I've got one eye in the past. Sometimes it's a curse and a burden, but a lot of the time it's not. It's one eye in the past, both based on the experiences, to see how maybe I could do something to benefit the future. If there's something I've done, you know, that kind of thing, if it's been done in the past or in a certain way. But I always look back. I've always got that memory. It's right there. It never leaves. Of looking back on Lampeter and thinking that those 4 years I'd love to have back.
Ah, that's a brilliant answer, and I completely share that. But now, normally at this point, I would say thank you very much for being my guest. But you are going to finish, by the sound of it, with your signature. I want to hear what this is all about.
Okay. So the quick history on this one, because I know we've gone well over. Sorry, Chris, told you I like to talk. Right, okay. I had an actor who came on who's worked for Jim Henson for 25 years. He was in Star Wars, but he's worked as a puppeteer for Jim Henson. And someone asked this question to him. And ever since, I've asked every single person I've had on my show, because it's a great personality question. If you could have a Muppet created after you, yourself, as your own personality, what kind of a Muppet would it be, and why? It could be a new one, or it could be a mix of any.
I would answer that by thinking of the Muppet Christmas Carol, because what I loved about that is that it seems so faithful to the Charles Dickens story. It was done in a very Jim Henson Muppety way at the same time. And it sort of worked with the singing and dancing. My goodness, what a really good question. Pardon me, on this, well, doesn't want to say Scrooge, because that's not really me. But at the same time, what I like about the Muppets is that you could take anything, any kind of type from them, any sort of archetype. So what would I be? Well, I guess because I've always wanted to be on the radio, I'd have to be some kind of Muppet DJ. There we are. Can I be that? Can I be a DJ Muppet? Kermit the Chameleon? I don't know. Call it what you will. How would you answer that question? What would be your Muppet character?
I'd say I'd have to probably be a mix of Fozzie Bear and... I've answered this one before. I said a mix of Fozzie Bear and Animal, I think. In some way. But again, I think it'd be a bit of Kermit because it's you're needed on set, Piggy. That's my Kermit impression.
Oh, I love that.
And also things like Miss Piggy when she'd go on the talk shows, and it was Michael Parkinson, wasn't it, who was interviewing her. Was that the one that was priceless because it was so in character and he was treating her as a real person, as a real actress? And she was just an extreme version of people who really do exist. And there was something very insightful about that interview. So I like that. I like the way we're going with this, Chris. Thank you. But it's funny when you ask about the Muppets, because the Muppets come out an awful lot. Because the Muppet Christmas Carol, well, one of the people I interviewed, who was one of my students, when I had a Nostalgia Night event, a concert based around this podcast, gosh, it would have been around November 2019, she did a reading from A Muppet Christmas Carol. It was really Dickens, but you know, she was using something that was used in the film. And it was so spot on, and you've touched on something there. You mentioned the Muppet, and some people go, wow, you know, we bow our heads. We are all awestruck by Muppetville.
Oh, definitely. And the Christmas Carol definitely is one of the best.
But amazing. Thank you so much, Chris, for being my guest this week and indeed being my first interviewee over Zoom.
Thank you for having me, Chris. It's been an absolute honour.